KALW.
One worker was like, you know, if the virus doesn't kill me, it's really the lack of jobs that's going to kill me.
COVID-19 rates are skyrocketing in Oakland's Fruitvale neighborhood as low-income immigrants risk infection to go to work.
Some people might know they're infected, but, you know, because of the need to survive, they'll still go to work.
We'll take a closer look at Fruitvale's infection rate and the community organizations that are trying to help. Then Oakland artist Paul Lewin talks about Afrofuturistic art and what it means to him.
I'm creating images of things that I've always wanted to see, stories that contain my history.
And we'll hear from a local poet reading from one of her two new collections that are out now.
It's a book of poems about living in the Bay Area in a place prone to fracture.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. In Alameda County, more than one out of every 10 COVID cases can be traced back to a single neighborhood's zip code. Fruitvale is a dense, predominantly Latinx community in East Oakland, and its COVID-19 case rate is higher than Florida's and higher than Georgia's, two of the hardest hit states in the country. KALW immigration reporter Teresa Katsourilis is here with me to break these numbers down for us. Hi, Teresa.
Hey, Hannah.
So we know Latinx communities have been disproportionately impacted by this pandemic. Residents are getting sick and they're dying at higher rates than white people. We've known that. But these numbers coming out of Fruitvale are still surprising.
They are. They are very high.
So why is Fruitvale getting hit so hard by this virus?
So there are a couple big reasons that this is happening. And I'd say the number one reason is that a lot of Fruitvale residents just can't stay at home. A disproportionate number of California's essential workers are Latinx, as we know. So those Fruitvale residents have to go to work. We're talking caregivers, grocery store workers, jobs like that. On the other hand, a lot of Latinx workers lost their jobs at the start of the pandemic, too. A high percentage of restaurant workers, domestic workers, and construction workers are Latinx, for instance. As that work starts kind of slowly coming back, some low-wage immigrant workers in Fruitvale are willing to risk their health to go back to work. This is one of the poorest parts of Alameda County. Some workers are undocumented, so they don't qualify for unemployment insurance or federal aid under the CARES Act.
And so there's no safety net for them.
Exactly. So I talked to Gabby Galicia about this. She's the executive director of the Street Level Health Project. They serve Fruitvale's low-income immigrant community. She says that when the Bay Area locked down in March, up to 90% of day laborer jobs just disappeared. And that's just an example of one industry or one industry's example. And now that some of that work is starting to come back.
One worker, he was like, you know, if the virus doesn't kill me, it's really the lack of jobs that's going to kill me. I'm not going to be able to feed myself or feed my family or, you know, have a roof over my head.
So, Teresa, people are working wherever they can. Are they able to protect themselves from COVID-19 while they're on the job?
Sometimes, but not all the time. Gabby says some of her clients reported that employers didn't offer them masks to protect themselves, which in most cases is a violation of California state safety laws, to be clear. The San Jose Mercury News published a big story last week where they talked to over a dozen Fruitvale residents. They reported that workers told them they're afraid they'll lose their jobs if they test positive. And Gabby says things like that have actually happened. Just as an example, she says she helped out one day laborer who actually got laid off because another member of his household tested positive for COVID-19. His employer found out and decided to let him go just in case he was infected, too.
And that must make people pretty reluctant to go get tested for COVID-19.
It really does. Here's Gabby again.
Some people might know they're infected, but, you know, because of the need to survive, they'll still go to work.
Right. And that obviously contributes to the spread of the virus.
Exactly. And then just on top of that, there are other factors at play here, too.
Like what? Can you give us some examples?
Yeah. So Fruitvale housing, for instance, can be notoriously crowded. So once one member of a household gets COVID-19, it can spread quickly. Gabby says several workers have also complained that their landlords have tried to evict them over a positive COVID-19 diagnosis, even though that's a clear violation of the county's rent moratorium. So that's yet another disincentive or incentive to just not get tested.
Right.
Immigration status is also an issue here. Some workers fear that seeking medical assistance could put them at risk of deportation. And language is a factor here. Some of Fruitvale's most vulnerable residents are indigenous Mayan immigrants from Guatemala. Their primary language is Mam, not Spanish. So they haven't always gotten the information they need about the pandemic in the language they're really most familiar with.
And that is a lot to be thinking about.
Absolutely.
So what is Alameda County doing to try to fix this? This is clearly a really urgent situation.
They're trying a couple things. And the biggest new initiative that Alameda County is trying out is they launched a new program where they will pay low-income workers $1,250 to quarantine if they test positive for the virus. And that's regardless of that worker's immigration status. And you can understand the logic behind this, right? This way, workers don't have to choose between making enough money to pay their rent or feed their families and quarantining to protect their neighbors.
Although it can be argued that $1,250, is that enough to pay rent and feed their families?
That is a very real question.
Is that a one-time payment?
That is a one-time payment, at least for now, to quarantine yourself. And the county set aside enough money to help about 7,500 people through this program. So it's limited in terms of the number of people that it can help as well. Mm-hmm. This program is based on a similar program in the city of San Francisco. You know, the Bay Area is really trying some of these things out and kind of seeing whether or not they work. The county also just participated in an outreach campaign with the Street Level Health Project to hand out masks and other information in Fruitvale. So they're also working on communication strategies.
Right. I mean, all this with the backdrop of a community that may not be trusting government a whole
lot.
It's interesting to think about. And so I think that's the place where grassroots organizations that they can trust may come in place. What kind of local groups are working to help their communities?
So there's really been a Herculean effort on the ground. And I do want to stress that people are really trying to help their community here. The Street Level Health Project has launched an emergency fund to support Oakland day laborers and low-wage immigrant workers. They thought they would only raise $50,000. They've raised over $100,000. They also launched a hotline and reached out to hundreds of community members in both Mam and Spanish. Mm-hmm. They are distributing 100 bags of food a week. And they are still raising money to kind of continue these services. In addition to the Street Level Health Project, La Clínica de la Raza is also offering free testing for residents near Fruitvale BART station. And then smaller organizations like Tribe and Homies Empowerment are also assisting in food distribution. So we're going to link to a couple organizations on KALW.org if anyone's interested in checking them out.
Great. Thank you so much for the information, Teresa.
Thanks, Hannah.
Teresa Katsarilis is KALW's immigration reporter. Find her stories online at KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Afrofuturism is an art form and philosophy where Black people reimagine what the Black diaspora looks like in the future. If you've watched the film Black Panther or noticed sci-fi themes in the music of Janelle Monáe or George Clinton, then you know what I'm talking about. Oakland painter Paul Lewin is another example. His work features images of nature, folklore, and Afro-Caribbean women that appear both ancestral and futuristic. His colorful and intricate paintings have graced book covers of sci-fi greats Octavia Butler and N.K. Jemisin. KALW's Janae Darden spoke with Paul Lewin about how his Jamaican heritage and love for sci-fi influence his creativity.
Your art is incredible. I think your story is incredible. I know you were born in Jamaica, and your dad was an influence in your art and in your life. How so?
He was definitely my first artistic influence. He was a woodworker, and I would help him with various different projects that he would work on. And it was in those projects that we would talk about creativity and about art and his work ethic, you know, and his joy of creating things and just how hard he worked on his woodworking projects. He had a full-time job. He would work during the week. He would work 5 days a week. One of the biggest things that he created was a train set, because he was into model trains. And it was a pretty big train set with mountains and rivers. And it was something that he had worked on for about 8 years. And I would help him throughout those years working on it. It just inspired me to work that hard. And it inspires me today in the way that I work now.
So was he working, when he was working on this, was this in Jamaica or had you already moved to the U.S.?
I'd already moved to the U.S. at that time. I was born in Jamaica in 1973. I moved to the U.S. in 77. And we lived in New York for about 1 year. Then we moved to Miami. I lived in Miami for 27 years. And that's mostly where I grew up, was in Miami.
And it's funny because I can see that in the artwork. I can see Jamaica. I can see Miami in your artwork just because of the colors, especially some of the blues you use. It reminds me of when I've gone to Miami and the water and like some of the hotels, like the blues that they use. So I can definitely see that in your work. But I know something else that's influenced your work aside from culture and where you live is science fiction and fantasy. What kind of fantasy and science fiction were you into growing up? Were you reading sci-fi books? Were you, you know, watching films?
It was a combination of both, but I would say mostly watching sci-fi films. When it came to reading, I was into a lot of fantasy, such as Lord of the Rings, and anything that had to do with dragons and swords and, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, things like that. But for movies and films, I was into Star Trek very heavily, Star Wars, Battlestar Galactica, Buck Rogers, you know, all of those, all the 80s, 70s, 80s classics.
So you talked about how, you know, when you were growing up, you were into sci-fi and fantasy and Lord of the Rings. And I know for a long time, you know, Black people, we've been wanting a space for our own science fiction, for our own fantasy, in art, in media, in film. And I'm looking at your work right now. I have a postcard of one of your beautiful pieces. This is The Visitor. And you created your own idea of fantasy, you know, using like images of Black people and Black culture. How did that all come to you?
Well, yeah. So it was similar for me, definitely growing up. I didn't even recognize it, though, as a kid. It was just that's what science fiction was. These were the characters that we were given. I was really into it, and it was exciting, and, you know, the idea of being able to go to all these different worlds. But it really wasn't until I got a bit older that I started noticing that, yeah, these characters weren't representative of me and my culture and, you know, the people in my family, my friends. And a lot of the times what happens now is that I'm creating images of things that I've always wanted to see, stories that contain my history and representations of me and my culture. And, you know, to hopefully also be able to inspire, you know, kids growing up so that they'll see representations of themselves.
But it's interesting too, because with your work, it's futuristic, but you see the past as well. I mean, like, you know, a lot of your work, as you said, infuses the ancestors. And I definitely picked up on that the first time I even saw your work. Why blend the future and the past?
Yeah, it kind of just happens that way. I don't know if it's something that I do on purpose, but I like taking elements from my ancestry, from our history, and fusing them with the future. And it's just these ideas of future ancestors, what our ancestors might look like in the future. And bringing those elements together, it's part of what inspires, you know, Afrofuturism, the concept of taking the Black experience and putting it into the future. You know, it's not just adding Black characters to the future, but it's taking the Black experience and combining that with futuristic images. And it kind of just comes together that way.
Why do you think there's such an interest in Afrofuturism? I mean, it's really blown up, you know, recently. And Octavia Butler is credited with being kind of the mother, the godmother of Afrofuturism. But we've seen it really expand. We've seen it really grow with Black nerd culture, Black geek culture. Why do you think there's such an interest in Afrofuturism right now?
I mean, I feel personally that it's something that has just been, it's been there for a while. It's been there for a long time. It's been there since the 70s, you know, 60s. And now that it's starting to surface more into the mainstream, I feel that it's something that's just necessary that people want to see. And I believe it's not just, you know, Black people that want to see it. I think all cultures are interested in it because it's also something that they haven't experienced either. And it's actually really interesting and intriguing to people in ways that, you know, Hollywood for a long time and mainstream cultures just didn't think that it would be. They didn't think there was money in it. But I do believe Black Panther clearly proved that wrong. And there's just such a rich history of, you know, folklore and science and creativity in African culture that it's mesmerizing when it's put into creative ways, you know, that deal with the future.
That was a beautiful answer. Thank you. One animal that I've noticed that comes up in your work a lot is the hummingbird.
Yeah, the hummingbird, it's the national bird of Jamaica.
Oh.
And my dad loved birds and he loved the hummingbird. So it's just something, a symbol that's always been a part of my life.
Does it have any special meaning to as well, like a symbolism or?
So before the Africans and the Europeans came over, the Arawak and Taino peoples that lived in the Caribbean, they saw it as a sign of reincarnation. To them, the hummingbird was a sign of their ancestors that had passed on and were reincarnated as hummingbirds.
Oh, okay. You recently designed covers for Octavia Butler's Parable series.
Yes, I did, for her books. And it was unbelievable to me because she has been my number one influence over the past, I'd say, 10 to 12 years. A lot of her work has inspired the exact work that I'm doing now. And in the first two books that I read from her were Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents. So to have that come full circle, to have my art connected to her work on those books, it's still something that I can't fully wrap my head around. Just absolute appreciation to have that happen.
That was artist Paul Lewin speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. To see some of his work, go to our website, kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Bay Area authors have had to cancel launch parties and book tours because of the coronavirus, so we're bringing them to you in this series we're calling New Arrivals. Poet Tess Taylor lives in El Cerrito. She has two new books of poetry, and she reads a poem called Song with Wild Plum and Thorn from her collection Rift Zone.
The morning is cold and the world is hard, but even in fog, it is still midsummer. The kids need to play, and the grocery budget ticks toward nothing the way the world tips towards doomsday. The walls in my chest will not let me breathe, and all the screens flicker and still answer nothing, so I take the children down to the bike path, and with buckets and a few blessed hours wander a corridor of weedy fruit. Blackberry, wild plum, all overhung. We leaners or gleaners, half acrobatic, lost among boughs, alone till I notice others stopping with buckets or tiffins, in many languages, along these tracks picking what weeds we still hold in common as dry heat builds and fog thins. In common, the thought feels strangely radical, crumb or bloom beyond loneliness. For a while, I feel entirely animal, little forager, hungry for fruit. Black sparkle, pale pit and thorn, weeds binding some world together. A word appears in my mind. Hold fast, sprout, raw volunteer. For a while, it is hand to mouth and to bucket, breathing, still here. Still here.
That was El Cerrito poet Tess Taylor reading from her new poetry collection, Rift Zone. You can find more about that book at klw.org/newarrivals. And before we go, here's some new music from a local artist. This is Toma from Oakland. Their new album, Even Closer, came out this summer.
To suspend my desire for conclusion. Assume that nothing is static. To hope that little truths will keep emerging in time.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Vivian Bosu Skinner, Sarah Lee Sterland, Lisa Morehouse, and Marissa Ortega Welch. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shireen Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.